you go from going, I can't believe we've got a TV show, all the massive anxiety every week of trying to put something to air, getting judged, the like experiencing commercial ratings for the first time, and then getting told the words of like, we're cutting the show, like we're axing it. And I think what it did for us a little bit was remove the boogeyman of failure. It's the thing that stops people getting up in the first place, because they're like, well, you know, what if I fail? And the truth of the matter is you are going to fail lots. And then after a while, you won't.
And welcome to this In Conversation episode of Shameless, the pop culture podcast for smart people who love dumb stuff. Today, we are sitting down with the incredible Hamish Blake, a comedian and writer, and of course, one half of Australia's most iconic radio and podcasting duos, Hamish and Andy. Hamish is Australia's funniest person, yes, but he's so much more than that too. Behind the scenes, he's an incredibly supportive and kind person in the industry who is very generous with his time. He's a switched-on business person, and of course, he's a father of two. In this chat, we explore the career failures that came his way in his 20s, his best friendship and chemistry with Andy Lee, and why fatherhood brings him so much joy and fulfillment. Here's Hamish. Hamish Blake, welcome to Shameless in Conversation. We are delighted to have you here.
It is an honour to make my first appearance. All right, here we go.
Hey, how are you doing, Hamish? I mean, it's a pretty weird time in Melbourne right now. I think we're going to be locked down for the next 1,100 years. How are you doing through it all?
Look, I mean, I can't complain. I mean, I think I probably just feel the same way everyone else does. Like, it's a bit of a deep sigh. But I also, you know, I'm just aware that I'm lucky and we're lucky. I just know a lot of people doing it rougher. So I don't know. I think I'm a mix of like completely understanding the just group exhale that everyone made when Dan was like, sorry guys, you know, I did tell you that if you didn't mow the lawns, you can't go to Sam's party. You didn't mow the lawns, so you don't go to Sam's party. It's not like he's having all the fun in the world either. Like, he's got a very tough job trying to manage this whole thing. So I get it. Like, it just is what it is. It sucks. Like, it's just, there's no like secret thing we could do to make it suddenly not suck. But, you know, having said that, we're at home. Like, we got cute kids. Homeschooling is a bit crazy, but it's really fun too. And there's just, you know, we're lucky we got patches of fun. Like, my heart does go out to people that would have a much tougher struggle on their hands, either A, because they're actually sick, and like, let's not forget, you definitely don't want to have corona, because that doesn't sound like a fun thing to have, or that B, people that are like living alone and struggling a lot more with the mental health side of things. So all in all, you know, I feel very blessed that like we're up the end of the spectrum where it's a nuisance, but it's not, it's not devastating. It's just something that has to be handled.
Yeah, for sure. What are you filling your downtime with? We ask everyone who comes on this podcast, what are you reading, watching, or listening to? Do you have any recommendations?
I feel like my brain, this is the thing. I think everyone feels this locked down. You know, you just like, you know, days merging. You don't know what day it is. You just, my brain's gone a bit sludgy, I think. And it's this weird mix of like, then I like let my brain off the leash for a bit of a run, and the stuff that it does is, you know, I'll give you, I'm in my office, I'm at my like nook, my desk here in the house. But even this, I was like, I just get obsessed. Basically, what am I spending my time with? I would just get obsessed with something for a day, and then I'll get it.
Like what?
I'm going to show you rather than tell you, and you will laugh.
I'm scared.
I don't know,
feel
is
nervous.
This reversed? It is.
Easy pickings. What is that?
A self-teaching manual to the technological something of lock picking.
The technique of lock picking. So
who are you buying?
No one. I was just reading about lock picking, and then I realized you can buy all these lock picking tools, and it's like a book where you can pick locks, and it comes with this, like a clear glass padlock, so you learn, you can like see all the bits moving inside as you're teaching yourself how to lock pick. So honestly, to answer your question, I am at home.
You're about to rob a bank.
No, I am trapped. I'm a hostage to the impulses of my mind, and then I'll get them today, and then I'll buy something like Easy Pickings. And then for some reason, I'm just not feeling the same pull that I felt to it when I was looking at it online. And I've even written down on my to-do list for today, which isn't that long, learn lockpicking. Like, I'm like, come on, you bought the set. Do the lesson. That's it. Apart from that, we're just chewing through TV just ferociously.
Is any part of this, you know, you see a book called Easy Pickings or whatever it's called, and you think this is interesting, but also this could be good content? Like, does your brain operate like that, or do you kind of go to the interesting thing first and that naturally makes good content?
I think I've just been led by my brain. This doesn't make good content because, well, my brain tricks me into thinking it would make good content because here's what my brain would do. It would go, hey, or whatever. Like, I just assume the part of my brain that makes me do these things talks like this, you know, guy in an alley that you weren't expecting to walk past on your way home with the shopping at like 8 o'clock on a rainy night. And my brain goes, hey, you should get this and it will be great. And wouldn't it be awesome to know how to pick locks? And then for the podcast, as a funny thing to do, just go in, pick into Andy's house, just go in like at 5 a.m. and just get in and record him. And that will, you know, scare the shit out of him. And then that will be hilarious. And then I go, yeah, you're right. Actually, I would like to learn how to pick locks. And then that sounds like a really funny thing to do. But the problem is the guy that sells these ideas to me, he forgets to tell me that when I get this, I'll stop caring about this. I'm not going to learn how to pick locks. Like, it's only good content if I actually commit to like the 6 hours it's going to take me to master lock picking, which I don't know if I'm going to.
The likelihood of Andy Lee having a padlock on his front door, pretty low.
True, but I know I've scoped out the lock. It's pickable. Like, I don't want this to become people listening to the Shameless podcast are like, oh, it's like a thing now. It's like an in-joke that we break into Andy's house. It's it's for me, this is my private mission only, but I feel like I could still get him. But again, it's going to take a few hours to learn lockpicking. But just like everyone picking up a hobby in lockdown, like what? We definitely have time. That's the annoying thing about this sludge. We have the time. It's just hard to stay productive. Because I was like, that's it.
Yeah.
Learning Italian. Lockdown one, I was going to learn Italian. I was like, that is going to happen because it is. There's a course you can download that's just like an audiobook. You listen to it. I think his name is Michel Thomas. He's a French guy. And he's done like every language, and it's like the Suzuki method for kids that were ever forced to learn piano, where you like don't have to read music, you just listen to the music, and that was like what I did as a kid. And this is the same thing, like you don't have to write stuff down, you don't have to do vocab or like homework. You're meant to just listen and say these phrases back with the teacher, and I've had a mate that's gone like in 10 hours, you will be able to speak conversational Italian. And that was my goal for lockdown one. And then
give us one sentence. Do you know anything?
No es posible for Spanish. It's not possible. the Spanish one stuck a lot more than the Italian one stuck because I've listened to the first 10 minutes and you just go, oh man, I don't have 10 hours. You think, but you do have 10 hours because you just look at your screen time every day on my iPhone. It tells me you're on your phone for 4 hours. And then I turn around and I'm like, where am I going to find 10 hours across my entire life when I'm spending 28 hours a week looking at that little rectangle of junk?
Fuck.
Yeah, that's basically it. That's my real voice inside me responding to this other voice that's pestering me all day to fill my day with nonsense. My real voice is just there going, fuck, when will you start listening to this other voice and get on with some useful work?
I want to know, were you always like this? Like, has your mind always kind of jumped from thing to thing? As a kid, how would you have described yourself?
Good question. I think I probably have always had this kind of a brain. In fact, I've probably learned to harness it a little bit more because honestly, in meetings and things like that, like when we're back with our radio show days where we would spend a lot more time in meetings, you'd have to, you know, we'd have like an hour long meeting a day. And it became a thing where I, like Andy understands this, but it's a difficult thing to explain to people. I need to be distracted to pay attention, if that makes sense. Like I would need to be looking at something online or drawing or whatever to pay attention. Because otherwise, if I'm forced to just pay attention, I find it you know, like a cripplingly, yeah, it just doesn't work. My brain, it's a weird thing. My brain needs to be distracted a little bit to then jump in to do whatever it is I'm there to do.
I want to know, and this is probably the world's worst question to ask like a comedian, but did you always know you were funny? Like at what point in your life and your childhood did you think I can actually make people laugh here? Like this is a thing I can do.
I think, I mean, I always liked comedy without it. And like, I didn't really prescribe it to a thing that came from me, but I, you know, I just was in like intoxicated by the idea, whether it was like through books or, you know, even like early cartoons or stand-up and stuff. Like for my generation, you would see like the stand-up on Hey Hey It's Saturday. Just the idea that someone could, you know, that could do that, because I think I just enjoyed the, you know, the generating of laughs. But it probably wasn't until, you know, you get to be much older, like I suppose in your teenage years, where it probably starts out about just like being a smart ass. And then, you know, then you hope it matures from there, but maybe it hasn't. But I guess that's like your first inkling of going, oh, okay, and kind of enjoying that like mental puzzle, I guess, of going, what's a fun way to solve this into this immediate thing, or, you know, this like this, what's a fun way to solve this moment in an unexpected way that could make people laugh? I suppose I remember having that feeling like around, you know, your teenage years when, I suppose it's when you, like now that I'm thinking about it, it's when you make adults laugh that I reckon you start to go like,
yeah,
all right, that was different. Because you can all make, you know, when you're eight, you can make your friends laugh, you just be a dickhead. But then it's sort of like, I think you remember that time when you're a teenager where you can make adults laugh, is sort of like, that's a high bar to jump for a teenager. So you remember those moments.
Let's talk about you being a teenager. You said on an interview with Willosophy, I was agitated to get on with life, but I was paralyzed by fear. What did you mean by that as a teenager, being paralyzed with fear?
Good stenographer reading of the Willosophy podcast. It feels like a deposition. That's a great question. I do remember having this conversation with Will, and I'm glad this is good, because the fun thing about Willosophy, and I suppose about this kind of conversation too, is you're not really thinking you're going to talk about these things, and then you kind of stumble through it for the first time, and then it's like 2 days later where you're like, I probably have said that a lot more succinctly. Where I think that feeling of being agitated to get on with life, it's that thing where you knew, you know, let's say, for example, if you're someone that's like, all right, I want to go on adventures, I want to bust out of the sort of the prescribed mold that I can feel has been laid out before me. So you can, it's the beginning of hearing that voice or the beginning of feeling that pull, but then hot on its heels, because you're like 14, insecure, only just hit puberty, which is quite late. You're racked with all these reasons why your brain is sort of saying to you, but just, well, you shouldn't do this. Like, what if you get, you know, all the normal teenage stuff, like, what if you get made fun of? Like, all the reasons to kind of stop you from taking that leap of faith. So I suppose it was that, you know, I could begin to feel those feelings of going, well, what if you didn't do what you thought you were meant to do? And really just that, you know, just starting to listen to your own desires or your own impulses or your own passions. But then everyone has that voice, or I did when I was a teenager. I think it's a common thing to have that voice of going, you know, don't do this, but what if, you know, what if it fails? What if you look silly? What are you thinking? You can't go on an adventure. Don't think about that. Just do the safe thing. Like, just get, you know, a lot of that's thinking of like, just get these few next predictable things done and then maybe do something else. So that's the fear of like, you know, of living riskily, I suppose, or taking that kind of, you know, taking a leap. And then you look back and you realize like sometimes it takes years and years and years to do something that seems very simple, like just, yeah, you know, just doing the thing that you want to do, or just having the courage to explore your passions or something that feeds your soul a bit more rather than what you think you're meant to do. And then when you become an adult, to some extent, you look back and you're like, oh my God, why don't I just do the thing that I knew that would make me happy or that was sort of calling me? But that's, I guess, what I'm talking about. Easy in hindsight to look back, but at the time, your brain's just come out with 100 reasons why you shouldn't do it and you should do something safe.
I want to jump ahead a bit because I want to know, when did you first realize that Hamish and Andy was a thing, like a thing that was really working and that it was a thing that you could probably pursue for a very long time?
Great question, because the early days of Hamish and Andy were really, if you go like started Hamish and Andy was like, well, me and Andy met at uni and we had a lot of fun hanging out, but not, you know, there was no moment, like there was no joke that we made at the uni bar where we just dropped our beers and went, this is good stuff. Like, with this should be commercialized. And there still hasn't been one of those. So it's been 20 years and we're still looking for that, zinger. But it was just like a strange kind of confluence of events where met each other in uni. We just basically had fun mucking around and had an interesting comedy. Like, I was starting to just like want to do stand up, and Andy was like, oh, you know, I think it'd be fun to make TV. And then my best mate, Ryan, I was like, well, you know, Ryan's down the road at a different university. He's super funny. We should all do stuff together. So it was really just like exploring, you know, what can we do? And we were making videos and sort of sketches. And this is pre-YouTube, so there weren't like a lot of outlets to do stuff. But we just started making it. We just started making it before there was a place to, you know, we were just kind of making it to show our friends, really. And then Tim, who's another one of my mates that I went to high school with, and Dunk, one of Andy's mates, we all kind of convalesced into this fivesome that would shoot and edit and write sketches for a show that we didn't have. But that was sort of, we were like a group. And then it was only because we put it on community TV. It was exactly the plot of Wayne's book. We put it on community TV, and then Channel 7 at the time were like, well, we have a current show that we want to rejig, and we want some new people for it, like a comedy show. And we, you know, all you guys should just come in and audition. And they randomly, like, honestly, the start of Hamish and Andy was like, they randomly assigned, okay, well, Hamish and Andy, you guys come as a pair, and Duncan and Ryan, you come as a pair. Could have just easily been the other way around. And they wanted duos. And so they just gave us a script that was like a two-hander, and then same with the other guys. And so they really just kind of started from there, where they're like, oh, okay, you guys seem to work okay together. And then it just became a thing that on that show we would do stuff in the studio together. And then just really through that period, kind of exactly at the same time, we went to radio as well. And when I was working at a radio station behind the scenes, and we're like, can we just have any slot? And so we did 10 till midnight on a Monday night and just started as Hamish and Andy. So it was a kind of a, it really was a bit of a random thing. And it was probably the people there in the production company and Channel 7 that more were like, no, this works. This is the thing. Because we're like, you know, we were 21. So, like, anyone who's 20, 21 doing comedy, you'd finish and be like, I don't know, was that anything? Because you don't know about TV. Or, you know, we were like, is this count as TV or is this terrible? What is this? And then people would go, no, that's good, that worked. Or, you know, often, no, that's not really working. But when you'd have someone like higher up going, yeah, great, we want to put it on TV, you'd be like, all right, well, I guess there's something here because we want to put it on. So I think it was kind of, we were maybe more pulled into it rather than pushing ourselves into it in the early days. That was certainly my memory. We weren't sort of kicking down doors going, have we got the comedy duo for you? And really, the reason I think we fell in love with it and we kept at it was because, you know, we've always been pretty driven by the feel of something. And I think, like, me and Andy's philosophy was the same. We were like, well, we don't have any plans for this thing, but this is fun and this is a good adventure. And now that we've kind of accidentally fallen through a few of these doors, you're in this kind of weird situation where you've just leapt into a few unknowns that aren't presented very often. And so suddenly you're part of the club that's been on TV. And that doesn't mean you're good. It just means you kind of were lucky and that were around and whatever. But that's a lower proportion of people than tried out. So you're like, all right, well, now we're in this club. What's the next adventure we could go on? And that's sort of, we just, I think, made a pact and understood that we just wanted to go where the fun was. And rather than it being any sort of commercially driven opportunity. So there, and then radio definitely was that arena for us. Like, it's an awesome spot. Like, you guys are discovering, like, it's like you get to invent 2 hours of content every day. So it was a great place to kind of learn and hone it. Mm-hmm.
What I find interesting about you guys and your story is it's easy to look back and feel like your rise was meteoric and you guys never experienced failure or setbacks. And I don't think that was the truth at all. I've like heard that the sketch show didn't work out exactly how you would have wanted. And
stinker.
You did have setbacks in those early days. And I want to know, like, how did you guys keep going? How did you guys kind of move through any self-doubt that might have arisen in the first couple of years?
I mean, I think that show, the show ended up being called Hamish and Andy, which was sort of a surprise to us as well. And I mean, if we'd have felt like we could have protested at the time, we probably would have. But in the end, it was probably a good thing for it to have happened because, again, you're 21, you're just getting told a lot of stuff. And I think our general answer to a lot of the stuff we got told during that time, and there's like, you know, there were good people around that had good intentions, but we were just learning the number one thing that you eventually learn in TV and radio and entertainment, which is the old saying, like, nobody knows anything. Everyone's just making it up, guessing, having a go. No one knows anything. So they were like, well, we think we should call it Hamish and Andy. And we're like, oh, wow, really? But it's like not, you know, there's a lot of other people on the show and we've only just came in. But they're like, no, it's good. That's what, this is the kind of thing you do. I'm like, okay, well, this is the kind of thing you do. And I guess we're doing it, even though it kind of felt a bit weird to us. So then, you know, the show, like I said, no one, there's never any guarantees, but you can kind of predict there are some good environments to make shows and some good rules to follow to make hopefully good shows and some good rules to follow to avoid. This was probably never going to work. Like, it was a bunch of different worlds jammed together. So, you know, it's a great example of you just got to find something that cohesively works rather than bursts of individual brilliance. So anyway, that didn't work, but we were 21 and you get, you know, you get told, you go from going, I can't believe we've got a TV show, all the massive anxiety every week of trying to put something to air, getting judged, the like experiencing commercial ratings for the first time, and then getting told the words of like, we're cutting the show, like we're axing it. And I think it was a great thing. It was a great thing to happen. We weren't actually even, I mean, we were like, we just weren't even that surprised. Like we knew it was coming, but I think it's just that thing of we had each other. We had each other and it just made it funny quicker. You know, like it just made it, no, you know, we didn't want to have failed. Like we weren't trying to fail and we took it seriously. So there's that, like, there's that disappointment that something you tried really hard at hasn't worked. But all it meant was like it's just not broadly commercially successful. And you know, nor did it have any right to be. Like things got to be good. And like, there were parts that were good, but there were parts that weren't good enough. But I think we learned that lesson. We were just like, oh, well, what this means is like, you know, you panic for a second, but you're like, but after a week, life moves on and life rolls on and then people are doing other stuff. Mm-hmm. And like the world didn't stop, the world didn't end. There was a headline that said that you got axed, but you know, no one you care about thought any differently of you. In fact, a lot of the people that you care about the most in the world were going through it with you. And we all had a chance to kind of be good at failing and learn together and have a laugh about it and move strong and move through it. So I think what it did for us a little bit was remove the boogeyman of failure in the same way that, you know, that people that are doing stand-up just go and bomb for nights on end because it removes the boogeyman of failure. It's the thing that stops people getting up in the first place because they're like, well, you know, what if I fail? And, you know, the truth of the matter is you are going to fail lots. And then after a while, you won't. And then when you do fail, you will also realize, yeah, that's just the failing bit. That's just the bit where you fail. it doesn't feel great, but it also nothing changes. Like, you know, your parents don't love you any less. Like your friends don't love you any less. No one that knows anything in the industry is going to think any less of you because it happens to everybody. But before you're in that experience, you imagine all those things would happen if you were thinking about it. So, yeah, I think what it made us, it was a great experience. And that's why I'm glad our names were out there because it kind of made it a bit more of a harsh failure because it was like, it's your name. It's not like, I was on a show called, like, you know, All Stops to Happyville and it was a funny sitcom that no one liked, you know, and my character, Mitch, the train driver, people hated. It's like, oh, well, that's just a bad character and a bad show. This was like a bit more personal because it's like Hamish and Andy was bad. This was like the message. and so you, for a moment, you know, there's that, you realize if you buy into that message, you are buying into a total fantasy because you realize when that message is there, it's written about or whatever it is that's coming back to you, you're like, well, they don't actually mean you're a bad person. It's just, you know, the show that you did wasn't funny enough to be successful as a comedy show. And that's fair enough because that's the game you're playing. So I don't know. I think that it was a great thing to go through because it kind of teaches you that it's a game. It is a bit of a game. It's one you take seriously and one we adore and we love and we would rather, you know, do well. You want to do well at what you do, but it is not who you are. It's not really worth getting devastated to that extent.
Coming up after the break, Hamish discusses why being a dad is the best job he's ever had. But first, a word from today's sponsor.
I wanted to ask you about your friendship with Andy because Sam Kavanagh, your old producer who produced the show for over a decade, once told us this story that is one of my favorite stories ever. And I'd love to know first and foremost if it's true. But he once told us that when you guys were all filming Caravan of Courage or something like that, you would live on top of each other for days on end. You would be in the smallest living confines. You would be working. You would be traveling. You'd do it for weeks. And then Sam said that on the flight home, everyone would try and get distance from each other because you've all been on top of each other. And you and Andy would just like sit next to each other and yap all the way home because you could just keep talking about anything and you didn't need space from each other. And I found it one of the most remarkable things in the world that through that story, it appears like you really just genuinely loved each other's company and didn't need space from each other. Is the story true? And is that kind of the nature of how your relationship has functioned?
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine it's not true because we always do sit next to each other on planes. So in that sense, yes. And but I think at the heart of it, like that's what appeals to us most about Hamish and Andy. It's like we want to do it. Like we want to hang out with each other and do that stuff. And maybe that's what we sort of realized early days. And it felt normal to us because it just felt like a normal friendship. But maybe as we've got older, we're like, oh, you know, we've got something a bit unique here where when we get together, like to do radio, to do Caravan of Courage, or when we're with a big team and we're making a show, we just have a real simpatico. I think a huge part of the appeal to both of us, we both like efficiency and time-saving stuff and labor-saving devices, love a shortcut. And I think we realize that our relationship is a massive labor-saving device. Like everything is so much easier when you're working with someone that has telepathy and simpatico with you. Like we can sometimes spend so much time with each other planning something and talking about something. And historically we have, and we're like, you know, you only need to get 10% into a sentence before the other person knows where you're going. And then they leapfrog and then they only need to get 10% and then you leapfrog them. And we get into that zone. And then you go back to talk to the rest of the team and you have to like readjust the way that you explain things because you're not talking to people that are,
the other 90% helps.
Yeah, they just don't have that kind of same gearing with you. And that works extremely well for like what we love doing and the adventures we love going on and creating the kind of shows and content we've created. So when we're in those zones, it doesn't make any sense to us to not, we would never go, oh, that's enough from you, mate. I don't need to see you. But having said that, then outside of the shows and stuff, like we do know we need space from each other to keep what we've, like we've learned over almost 20 years, like, of course we go off and have other holidays and stuff with other people and flex other parts of our brain and different parts of our personality. And, you know, that's probably when you think about the most normal part of all this because, you know, we are different human beings and everybody is a different human being than their best friend. And so you know, you've got your own identity and your own person and he's his own person. But I think it makes it that whatever that weirdness is when we come back together, that glue, it just helps make it stickier when we come back together. So yeah, that's probably very true from Sammy's perspective that we did that. If I had to guess, I'd say that we also were probably like had gone deep on some random iPhone game to try and get top. We would try and find like a really unpopular Nokia game. This kind of tells you how long ago it was. Like often we had burner phones on the things like for like local SIM cards. So you'd have just a burner phone for 3 months or 3 weeks, sorry, while you're traveling around India or the UK or something, and there would always be like one game on it that we would become obsessive with about like who can get the top score on this game.
Love it. I want to know, what do you love about Andy, not just as your coworker and business colleague, but also as your mate? What do you love about him?
Lovely question. There's so many things. I mean, like, obviously super funny and also helps me have a kind of fun that I can only have with Andy. Like that, I got a real kind of, you know, and Andy fun. And I guess that's what we sort of end up doing on screen, but there's also a big part of that that's just for us that kind of happens off screen, which I also cherish as well. You know, and he taught me a lot too. I met him when I was 19 and you know, one of the things I love about Ando is he's a good risk taker as well. He's a fun guy to take a risk with. Like, he's very sensible, which teased me about a little bit. Like, he's analytical and he won't take dumb risks, but he's got a great, you know, a lot of the fun things in life that I got to do were because he has, maybe, you know, he kind of levels me out. He drags me up in terms of like, well, let's just go and try something really optimistic. And you know, that led to a lot of fun things in life. So, and then on a personal side of things, that I'd say he's an extremely loyal and caring man in that sense. Like, has a great knack of creating like a great team or great kind of, you know. Had we not just come and done this thing that we were doing, like, he probably would have just been like a good. Like, whatever he chose to do, he'd be a great leader in. Like, people would be like, yeah, I enjoy being on that team because it's good for morale. So it just extremely buoyant, has that effect of buoyancy. And that's a great fun thing. Like, whether you want buoyancy, like just having a beer and having some fun, or if you're like, I want, you know, we've got this huge, big project we're doing together, he's got that ability to kind of, you know, he's a rocket ship. He's like a boost. He's a rocket booster.
There is this saying about success and about having a public persona that goes something along the lines of, the higher you climb, the windier it gets. I want to know if that resonates with you at all, and if you think that is true when you've probably climbed to the highest point in Australian mainstream media.
That is a good saying. I mean, it comes with, I suppose what that saying sort of trying to get at is, like, it becomes a bit more variable, maybe. Like, it, you know, I suppose if you're up a windy tree, like, it is going to, it's, you get a bit of volatility. Like, fame is a very interesting word to use. I suppose there's kind of like a few schools of fame where you've got to decide what you're in it for. And I guess, you know, there are some people that do see fame as an outcome or as a goal. That's not how I view it. But if you were looking at fame as a goal, I guess they could see it could get very, very windy the harder you try to be famous, because I think what you would essentially be doing is losing touch with who you are. And fame is not a terrible thing. It's just a thing that has consequences and costs associated with it. Mm. So we, you know, we're extremely lucky. Like, this is, it's always a tricky thing to say, because I'm super grateful for the lives we have, the opportunities we've been given, and that comes from your audience, really. Like, I'm just eternally grateful for the people that have bothered to tune in, that have bothered to download things, that have bothered to pay attention when they could have been paying attention to something else. So the awareness that comes from that, I'm is one of the most precious things I think that's ever happened, because it's allowed us to have this journey and this platform, and it's given me a career. Like, you have to, I am just super grateful of the audience. Like, that's one group of people. Then there's just general fame around that, that means you just are known, that when you walk down the street, people know who you are and you don't know who they are. And, you know, I feel really fortunate, especially in Australia, because almost exclusively, in fact, very, very close to 100% of those people are just lovely interactions. They're people going hi or whatever, I've listened to something, I've seen something, and it's just a lovely thing, and you say hi and get to, you know, you get to meet someone, you get to know who they are, and it's like, it's a, I get energized by those kind of interactions. But I think if you're someone that just wanted to be famous for the notoriety of it, that would be a different thing, because I always still feel like those people, that's a you know, for me, that's a really bearable, pleasant, like, happy kind of fame, because it's to do with work. It's to do with my work, and it's to do with my job, and it's to do with the thing that I care about, which is making things and being creative and hopefully making people laugh and hopefully trying to put something good in the world. And then fame is a result. It's like it's an offshoot or it's a byproduct of getting to do this job I love, but it's not the goal of getting to do the job I love. I think if fame was your goal, you could possibly, you know, you could find it a little more difficult to stay in touch with who you are and what you care about.
Mm. I find it interesting that you are someone who achieved so much success so young, that in your 20s and your early 30s, you really built up this incredible career. And now it feels like fatherhood plays such a seminal role in your life. Can you talk to us about how much you love being a dad?
I do. I adore being a dad. Happy for it to be my main job. And I guess that's why, you know, when we were sort of chatting before about lockdown, like, you know, I don't feel like I can complain really at all, because we've got a lot of time to hang out with the kids and get to be a dad. And if I had to choose, If I had to choose, I would say that would be my preferred way to spend my time. We've had to cancel work stuff, but again, I'm not that bummed about canceling work stuff. I feel very lucky to have the job I have, and I sort of feel like any time we get to do a job is still a bit of a fluke. So canceling it just feels like half of the course. Like, I'm surprised we're still going. So, but being a dad, in terms of what I was saying before about, like, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to put into the world? Where do you want to focus your energy? You know, for me, being a dad, I can't think of a better use of my time for being a dad. For me, like, I adore it. So, and I'm just aware how, you know, it just is going. It's going fast. So you can't really slow it down, but being the only antidote for that is just trying to be as present as you can.
That kind of takes me very seamlessly to my next question, because I actually think I loved this so much that I asked Zoe about it on her interview with us too, because on Willosophy, you spoke about your philosophy, where you spoke so beautifully about how you're obsessed with this idea of, like, making memories, and that you said, if you would tell yourself at 80, how much money would you pay to go back to this moment right now where you're in your 30s and hanging out with your kids when they're little, how much would you pay for that? And I think you say in that interview that it helps you be really present because you think you'd pay all the money in the world to come back to these moments. I want you to speak a little bit to that, if you would, because I love that philosophy and I want to know how it manifests through your life.
I think, it manifests itself a lot through my life, just in terms of going, I don't, and I'm not judging anyone that does this, but I'm like, I wouldn't look at a thing that took me away from the kids as like, oh, well, that's work, you know? It's just super important to kind of keep in my mind. I suppose in another way of looking is like, I'm terrified of going, oh my God, how did I not realize that that was going to be the case, that was just going to be big and that was it and you've missed it? So I am hyper aware of that, you know, and we're all busy. Like, this is, you know, there's lots and lots of parts of the day where I'm like, I'm so sorry, guys, I have to do this thing. I would love to play on the couch, but I, you know, it is a balance, of course, all the time. But I think by being aware of it and by being conscious every day of that idea that they will never be this little and you'll never be here again. I mean, if COVID's taught us anything, surely it's that. It's like, you don't know what next year brings, and there's nothing we can do about that. The only thing you can really do is it forces you to pay more attention to the present, because it really is the only thing that we've got. Like, I think it's just a way of reminding yourself that this is all we've got. And then when you are 70, you'll go, well, I can't go back and I can't have them little, but I know I'm at least comfortable with knowing that when they were, I was there and I made it count, I suppose. And I don't know, I've seen a few things in my life too where I admire people who realize there's no point putting things off. And I've seen evidence of a few people thinking that, oh, well, you know, I'll finish this thing and then I'll do the thing that I want to do or whatever. And I don't subscribe to that. I ferociously subscribe to the opposite of that. I ferociously subscribe to, we have to do this now. We have to make memories now, and we have to do the hard work to book in an annoying trip, even though it means it's going to mean shuffling a lot of work stuff around, because when we get there, we'll go, why don't we do this more often? And that's that plays a big role in my mind too. Like, I kind of have this conversation with my friends a little bit when we're trying to, like, plan some sort of weird adventure, because I'm like, it's annoying, we've all got kids, we're trying to get away, we're trying to, like, spend, you know, 4 days away with each other. I know I just said I would never do anything away from my kids, but, you know, you've got to balance it out.
God, this is not, fraud.
You know, you do need time away from your kids. Or you're going, like, you know, let's all, you know, I'll organize a camping weekend for just, you know, me and Sonny's like, it's a hassle, we need gear, it's gonna rain, you won't sleep. All those things are true, but the opposite is then you just didn't do it. Like, if the alternative is like, well, we could do this fun adventure, we could have all the, we can, we have this memory forever, or the alternative is it's just another weekend, that's kind of unacceptable to me. Like, that's why I like kind of putting effort into trying to make, whether they're big moments or small moments, whatever, just something out of the ordinary happen. I think it's always worth the effort, because that's the stuff you're going to look back on and go, I'm glad that I didn't just pick the easy option, which was not doing it. So, yeah, that is on my mind. That is on my mind a fair bit.
This sounds like more of a morbid question than it is, but we tend to ask as many people as we can, and we want to know, what do you want your legacy to be?
Oh, that's not morbid. I think that's sort of what we were talking about before, is like, I think it's probably healthy and sensible to be aware of just how kind of fleeting this all is, because it's just ferociously quick. So I think the legacy that, you know, I suppose for anyone with kids, then there's this sort of like, how would you like your kids to remember you? And I guess that is, you know, if it was all over for me next year, there's going to be a slightly different legacy than if hopefully it all goes to plan and it's all over when I'm about 93 and still pretty fit, but just ready to go. But I think in a nutshell, you'd want the legacy to be, whether it was professionally or as a dad, I think just trying to put something good in the world. And I think hopefully just valuing the power of joy and laughter as something that we should make time for and that is important, rather than something that we should fit in if we have time. And that's kind of a little bit of my philosophy, for part of the philosophy I have for parenting is, you know, when we talk about memories or even just like little moments in the backyard or on the couch or at night, it's like I put a high value on putting some effort into moments of joy, because otherwise it is one of those things where you're like, oh, well, you know, we've got a lot of stuff on our plate and we'll just do fun things when we have time. And I don't think that should be the order of operations. I think you should prioritize fun and joyful things, not at the expense of, like, you know, paying rent or like cleaning that, you know, or having a sanitary living environment, but, you know, making space for it, making time for it.
Hamish, we finish every interview with the same question, and I'm very interested to hear your answer because you are one of the most successful people conventionally we've had on the podcast. How do you define success in your own life?
Good question. I think you've just got to have your own, you do have to have your own definition, don't you? Because it's like you said, I mean, whatever, conventional success, I suppose, like in the industry, I mean, it's like, you know, did you get a show? Did you get another one? Did you, or whatever it is, or did you get this gig or that gig? I think a big part of success is knowing what you're after, knowing what you want to get out of something. And then you will know if you got it. I think we all can think of a lot of people that are rich and not happy, you know, or a lot of people have powerful jobs but probably wouldn't say that they feel fulfilled and happy and successful as a human being. So, you know, I think it has nothing to do with external scoreboards and external markers. I think it probably has, it's who can land as close as they can to the internal discipline or like the internal standard that they set themselves. And I think if you can do that, then you've got a shot at feeling successful.
Hamish, thank you so much. As we say, we know you are very busy, and I think this has been a very nice chat to have when the world is very weird, because I feel much lighter for having had it. So thank you much.
And I also just realised my definition of success, I guess what I'm saying is you can totally rig it, have very low standards, and then just meet them. Well, I'm a success. It just sounds like when industries are allowed to self-regulate.
Thank you so much for listening to this In Conversation episode of Shameless with Hamish Blake. For more from Hamish, you can find him on Instagram, where basically all of Australia follows him anyway, at Hamish Blake Shots. Shots with a Z, of course. Oh, and you can obviously catch his podcast, Hamish and Andy, on all good podcast apps. If you loved this chat, we recommend you actually go back through our feed and listen to our interview with Hamish's equally impressive wife, Zoe. I will also pop the link to that chat in our show notes. She was incredible back in January. As for us, if this is your first time listening to Shameless, we are an independent pop culture podcast. We put out episodes every Monday and Thursday. We also have a monthly book club episode too. If you would like to keep up to date with us, please click the follow button on Spotify. You can also find us on Instagram at Shameless Podcast. Thank you so much, guys. We'll be back in your ears on Monday. Bye.